Welcome to the fifth United We Stand podcast of the season. I'm delighted to welcome Alex Stepney as our guest today. Alex, of course, is a former Manchester United goalkeeper. He made a total of 539 appearances for Manchester United. So that puts him sixth in the all-time appearance list behind Giggs, Sir Bobby Charlton, Paul Scholes, Bill Foulkes and Gary Neville. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you very much, Andy.
Did you know that you were six?
I knew I was around about that, but it was ironic you say it was, what did you say, 539. I think when I retired, well, when I left United, it was 535. And somehow I've been told it's gone up to 541. Now, I haven't played in these extra games, but no, I think they've added sort of Watley Cup matches in and certain things like that. So
okay.
It's great to be sixth of your time, you know, on the all-time list.
You born in Mitcham in Surrey. You played for your local club, Tooting and Mitcham United. Then you went to Millwall. What was Millwall like? You went there in 1963.
Yeah, it was an interesting one because basically I missed out as a schoolboy. Although I played for my local district team and then I was reserved for Surrey schools then and also London schoolboys because I was obviously on the borders. And being reserved, he didn't play because there was no substitutes in those days, and because the scouts from the 92 league clubs basically never saw me. So I had to go and play amateur football for Tooting and Mitcham, where I went through from the youth right through to the first team, right up to obviously May 1963 was, and ironically that was a bad, very bad winter, and the games were called off. So many games, I think, you know, 2 months. And my manager at Tooting and Mitcham, a guy called Derek Upton, who played for Charlton, obviously he was retired then, and he was wicketkeeper for Kent, and he knew people at Millwall. Millwall were looking for players because there was such a backlog of games. And I think I played about 8 games in their reserve team. At the end of the 62-63 season, so we finished runners-up in the combination. And the manager offered me terms to turn pro. So luckily, after sort of near enough 5 years of leaving school, I became a professional footballer in Millwall. And I suppose, really, the lads who like you, Joe, your besties and your Bobbies and Dave Sellers, all those lads who joined professional clubs after school, they had an apprenticeship, but I don't think they had such an apprenticeship like I did for Millwall in the old fourth division and third division.
Why? What's it like?
Well, it was hard.
Yeah.
But it was a great apprenticeship for me because, you know, in those days down there, you were then playing with players who were probably, there was a variation of young players in their 20s, 21, 22s, but you also had a big surplus of players who were playing who were in their 30s and sort of been down in those leagues. And it was hard. I tell you what, it was hard in those days, Andy, because you wouldn't get all the rolling over and diving like that. You were hit, the referees didn't bother about anything so much as though if you got hit and things like that. So you had to look after yourself. And that's where I basically learned my trade.
You must have done well because in May 1966, Millwall received an offer of £50,000 for you, a huge amount at the time, to join Chelsea, who were managed by Tommy Docherty. Was it right that the intention was to play you and fellow goalkeeper Peter Benetti in alternate weeks at Stamford Bridge?
Well, yeah, it was, as it turned out that way. And the thing was, Millwall done well in the third division in the 65-66 season. We won promotion to the second division. And in that year, which was obviously World Cup year, I gained 323 caps for Millwall, which was, you know, in the third division, which was basically unheard of in those days under Alf Ramsey. And obviously, I was ambitious then. I'd been a pro for 3 years, and I wanted to go and play in the first division. But before Chelsea came in, West Ham came in, and Ron Greenwood wanted to sign me. And I was going to sign for them, actually, but unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way, but Millwall and West Ham didn't really get on, and at the 11th hour it broke down. That's when Tommy Docherty came in.
I think
he actually offered 50,000, which was a world record fee for a goalkeeper in those days.
I think it's fair to say that Millwall and West Ham still don't get on, at least the fans.
I would think so. But the thing was, I wanted first division football, and because, not like today, in those days there was a first team goalkeeper and a reserve team goalkeeper, you know, because you didn't have to have three top class keepers in your squad for the simple reason you didn't have the European games then. And what happened was, I actually went to the chairman of Chelsea, Mr. Joe Mears, and said, you know, look, Tommy Docherty had said that Peter Fanatti was leaving. And I wanted to make sure. He said he was going to West Ham, which I knew possibly was on. I just wanted confirmation from the chairman of Chelsea. And ironically, he said, yes, he said, you sign for us. Tommy wants you as your first team keeper. You know, we're going to sell Peter to West Ham. So I signed. As simple as that. Unfortunately, before Peter signed for West Ham, because he didn't want to get away, Mr. Mears actually had all of a sudden died of a heart attack in Oslo with the England team before the World Cup began, and a new chairman came in and said, well, Peter Bonetti's not leaving. So that sort of held the situation for pre-season, that obviously Peter Bonetti was staying. I think he played the first three games of the season. Obviously, Tommy, I mean, at the time must have been under pressure to play him. And Peter actually, I think he got injured against Notts Forest, I think it was, and I was called in to play against Southampton, and I played against Southampton, and we won 3-0 down at Adel. And that's when he called us in on the Monday morning, and he said, look, he said, I've got the two best goalkeepers in the country, but I'm going to have to play you alternate games.
So
I was going to tell you, Peter and I looked amazed, but we had to go training, and you do your training, and after training, next thing I knew, I was told, I think it was by Frank Blanchard, who was obviously on the coaching staff at Chelsea at the time, to go back to the bridge, and the manager wanted to see me. And he took me to the White House Hotel near Euston Station without telling me what was happening, and we sat there in the lounge, and I asked the question, what am I doing? And he said, just wait and see. And right before my eyes, the swing doors opened, and Matt Busby and Jimmy Murphy walked in. And that was my exit from actually Chelsea and joined the fantastic Manchester United.
Matt Busby had decided that neither Pat Dunn or David Gaskell were up to the job of being Manchester United's first choice goalkeeper and spent all the money on you. What was your reaction when you saw Matt Busby and Jimmy Murphy at Euston Station?
Well, it was unbelievable, really, because, you know, I knew what Manchester United was and the players they had, and I mean, it was incredible. And but then again, you know, I'd had a challenge early on in me, you know, so when I left school, I had to sort of get through and sort of push on and try and be noticed, and it happened. And like I said to you, I had three under 23 games under my belt, which, you know, might not sound to anybody today, but in those days, when you're playing for a third division team, to be playing with the likes of Alan Ball and Martin Peters and Tommy Smith and people like that, you know, it made all the difference to my challenge to be playing for Manchester United, and it actually helped the situation. And ironically, the way I played as a goalkeeper then sort of fitted into the way Manchester United played, and it worked out very well for me.
Did you settle in at Manchester? Did you enjoy living in the city? Did you settle in at Old Trafford?
Yeah, I mean, the actual thing was that obviously I was in digs with Jimmy Ryan, actually, not far from, just around the corner from the ground, as it was in those days, you were in digs. And I think after about 5 weeks, well, we were doing well anyway. We, you know, the club were team was doing very well. I mean, Matt just said to me, I think it's about time now you moved up and bought yourself a house and etc. And I said, well, you know, no problem. He said, well, bring your wife up and away you go. And he said, I'll get an estate agent to show you around. And actually, it was him who showed us around. So, you know, that was the kind of guy he was, that he was like your father. And ironically, John Connelly had moved to Blackburn, and I finished up buying John Connelly's house.
I've asked United We Stand readers to put questions for you, and a load of them have been sent in. We can't ask all of them, but thanks for everybody who's sending them in. One of them is, which terrace did you least enjoy playing in front of, and what was the worst thing that you ever had thrown at you?
Well, I suppose really that I suppose it had to be City, didn't it? You know, I mean, there was a woman behind the goalie, I think her name was Helen, the blonde old blonde lady that had a big bell.
Helen the Bell.
The Bell, yeah, and because every time you sort of went for that end, you know, there was a bloody bell ringing in your ears. I mean, but I kept, you know, all fans were great. I mean, even the cop, I mean, they applauded you till you got to your goal and put your gloves and your cap in the back of the net, and then they booed you. But no, I mean, I think it's something that you knew what it was going to be like, but you know, it was your job, and you just concentrated on your game. And like any wherever you played, when the ball went behind the goal, because sometimes there's not a lot of ball boys in those days, you had to pick the ball up as it went sort of in the, you know, up towards the fence where the crowd were. You got the verbal, but you also there were some very witty people about, and you know, you had a little laugh yourself, but then you had to get on with what you were doing.
Another question is, do you look back and laugh about the goal scored against you by Pat Jennings in the 1967 Charity Shield?
Well, I do, because actually, I mean, it was just something that happened to me. It was like, I Bill Fulton, you know, your centre-back sort of was always deep, and when it was coming down, or so coming towards us, I thought Bill was going to control it and just pass it back to me, but so I just came off my line a bit, and because when he left it, he sort of ducked and left it flew over my head. I think the funniest thing about it, I mean, I know it's something that everybody laughs at, and the entire heart, to be honest, but was that the referee didn't even know what to do, but Jimmy Greaves and Alan Gourzine were really giving him some stick and saying it was a goal. But yeah, it was one of those things that happened. And like everything else, you know, every goalkeeper makes mistakes. Everyone's made a mistake. But luckily for me, it was a game we didn't get beaten. It was a Charity Shield game. And, you know, you've got to live with it for the rest of your life, but you've got to forget about it and get on with the next game. And luckily for me, that's the kind of person I am.
A year later, Manchester United had reached the European Cup final at Wembley, and a lot of readers have talked about a save you made from Eusebio, a very famous save towards the end of normal time with the score at 1-1. People have asked different things. Did it hurt you? What did he say to you afterwards? How did you feel when he applauded you? What do you remember about that save from a wonderful play in Eusebio?
Yeah, I mean, it was something that I never forget. The bosses sort of team talk before we went out into the tunnel at Wembley. He just said to Nobby Styles, "Nobby, I want you obviously to mark Eusebio man for man, like he did 2 years ago. You know, before the, you know, in the semi-final of the World Cup against Portugal, and that was a plan. Nobby was basically having to mark him. But when it was 1-1, I mean, we played well. We'd done all right. I mean, the first half wasn't a classic, but the second half, when Bobby scored with a header, a glancing header. But they were a good team, Benfica, you know, I mean, and it was just so hot in the stadium. But, you know, when it became 1-1, I mean, Grasser scored past me. And, you know, I think it was about 10 minutes to go. And there was no clocks around in those days, not like there is today. I mean, you were looking at the bench for time, and I knew it was getting close. And when the ball was played through, I've got to be honest, because it was the old Wembley pitch, it was very lush in those days. I thought the ball was going to, so I was like 55 or 60%. It was coming to me before it got to Eusebio as he was coming through. I was looking for Nobby because Nobby was nowhere around. And I actually came off the line a bit. I thought he was going to chip me a bit when the ball slowed up. But that split second told me he always wanted to smash the back of the net. You know, he wanted to burst the net, which enabled me to sort of go back and stand up. Unfortunately for me, he did hit it straight at me. There was no two ways about that. But I don't know how it stuck. You know, it just stuck in my chest. It's one of those sort of things that happen. And then gradually I knew I'd got the ball. I was more interested in starting, because I knew the time was running out, to start a counter-attack. And Tony Dunn was on his own. And the thing was to throw the ball to Tony Dunn.
So Eusebio...
I saw Eusebio sort of waving or sort of applauding to me, and that was it.
And how did you feel when he did that?
Well, I didn't think anything about it at the time, to be honest. I've got to be honest about that. I mean, it was something I was more interested in, you know, come on, let's try and get another goal. I mean, but looking back and knowing the guy, he's been all his life as a great sportsman, I can only appreciate what he did, in doing that. I mean, because he knew that, you know, he really had smashed the ball with all his power, because I would think possibly he was one of the hardest shots in football.
Was winning the European Cup your highlight in football, your highlight at Manchester United?
Now it is, yes. Now, not at the time. It's ironic because, as a kid when I was growing up, you know, and in school, as a schoolboy in the 50s, and the biggest thing was winning the FA Cup and playing for your country. And that was always my ambition. Because obviously we know about 1958, I think everybody who was alive at that time remembers it, but they knew where they were, and Manchester United became the Munich thing became part of your life, and for me to be playing for them, and not realising at the time that it was like 10 years after the tragedy that Sir Matt had built a team and I was part of it. I did want to win the FA Cup, and luckily and fortunately playing for United over sort of two decades, really, and what, five managers, somehow I got what I wanted back in 1977. But looking back now, I do realise what a big, massive achievement it was, more so than obviously winning the league and the FA Cup. But we wouldn't have won the European Cup if we hadn't won the league, because you're only winning to the European Cup in those days if you were league champions or you were a holder of the trophy.
You weren't just a shot stopper. Apparently you were decent in five-a-side, and you actually scored a few goals for United. In fact, you were joint top scorer at one point, at Christmas in one season.
Yeah, that was a crazy situation, I suppose, because what happened was, I mean, Tony Dot was manager and... things hadn't gone well with me the season before that when it came, but the actual thought was we went to a pre-season tour in Murcia in Spain, obviously there were just four teams, and it was just Murcia, obviously a Spanish team, and I think it was Valencia, played each other, and we played Penarol of Uruguay in the other game, and obviously they wanted a Spanish team in the final, and we actually drew with Penarol 1-1, and there was a penalty shootout. So we went through, and I took a penalty, and I saved one, and never thought no more about it. You know, I mean, we eventually won the pre-season tournament. And then, I think it was probably about the third or fourth game of the season, we were playing Leicester at home. It was an evening game, and I think Martin Buchan said to Tommy Dot, you know, who's taking the penalties? He says, where are we going out? And he said, Alex, and blooming hell, Sod's law, we got a penalty, and because it's Peter Shortening goals. I think everybody in the stadium was amazed that I ran the whole length from the pitch from the Stretford end, I mean, down to take the penalty against Peter at the scoreboard end, and because I did send in the wrong way, so that was what happened, and I took another one against Mike Kelly at Birmingham, and then I missed one against Wolves, and that was the end, but that was thing while I was top of the league at sort of Christmas with Lou McCarrie and Blanket and Sonny McElroy, was that unfortunately, we got relegated that season.
One reader said that the Wolves game you talked about was his first match in 1974, and he said he was alarmed that you missed a penalty at the sight of you running back to your own goal so that United didn't concede a goal.
Yeah, but I hit it so hard, it hit the keeper, it went for throwing, so I had a chance to get back. But it was really. I mean, I shouldn't have taken the penalties anyway. But that, I suppose, it was something that there wasn't a lot of a sort of responsibility in the team at that time, and that's what happened.
You mentioned 77, the FA Cup final win a year before. United played in the 76 Cup final against Southampton. One of our readers has had particularly difficulty getting over Bobby Stokes being offside pretty much for all his life since. I won't embarrass him, but he's called Alan Hargreave. He wants to know how far offside was Bobby Stokes that day.
Well, I mean, I didn't really know at the time, but I mean, when you see it on a DVD and that, I suppose it could have been a couple of yards, but I mean, it's like everything else, it's one of those talking points that goes on and on and on, but at the time, I was more concerned that he was through on his own, and it was, the ball was cutting across him, and actually, I mean, he actually mishit it, I think, and that's what done me, because it wasn't a really powerful drive, it was something that and those sort of shots can sort of get by you, because if you're diving too quick, because we think, you know, what's going to happen, and the ball hasn't gone that fast, but it's going away from you, already down, and you can't do anything about it, and it's in the back of the net.
Do you think that with modern advances in training and diet, you would be a better goalkeeper nowadays?
Oh, there's no two ways about it, in respect to fitness-wise and things like that. But the only thing is, today, I'd never get a chance, I wouldn't even get a chance to be in any team because I'm only 6 foot. I mean, today they're all 6'4", 6'5". And the trouble is, the goals are still the same size.
And what about the gloves? Did you started out not wearing any?
No, we didn't wear gloves. There was gloves came out. There were some cotton gloves, and I did eventually get a pair of gloves. Ron Springett, who used to play for Sheffield Wednesday, he came out with a pair. You know, I think in the late 60s, which were more like string, and they had on the on the fingers, inside the fingers, they had sort of like the pimples of a table tennis bat. Which I mean, it helped to a certain extent, but once they got wet, that was, they just expanded in your hand. It was nothing to sort of what they had today. I mean, I don't think I could wear what they had today. I mean, your hands, over the years, when you know, with all the work you've done, they harden and, you know, they're stronger. But, you know, the old spitting sort of bit of mud on your palms helped the situation. But, no, I mean, those gloves, the only thing I did, and there's a lot of things in your mind as well, don't forget, that, you know, you put on a pair of gloves, are they going to help you? The thing that I did with these gloves, fortunately for me, the wash lady or the laundry lady in Old Trafford, one day made a mistake and put them in bleach. And it actually made the sort of this table tennis bat pimples on this, and it made them a bit tacky, which sort of, I don't know, for some unknown reason, in my mind, thought, well, you know, that's going to help the situation.
So bleach assisted you?
Yeah, and because the gloves were pure white.
Who was the best finisher at Old Trafford when you played?
Oh, dear. That's a good one. Probably Dennis Lawton. I would say Dennis in respect. I mean, you're playing with three European footballers of the year, and three forwards who actually, with different styles, etc. But Dennis, in and around the 6-yard box, was unbelievable. But I mean, George, he beat everybody. He could beat five or six men to score a goal, and because Bobby was a great artist at scoring from like 20, 25 yards. But no, the ones that sort of, the times the ball go in and around that 6-yard box, Dennis always seemed to be on the end, and it was a fantastic header of the ball as well.
What did you think of the back pass rule being changed 20 years ago this season? Was it a good or bad thing?
Well, I suppose it's something that has proved, people, everything about it, that it's going to create more goals, obviously. it was quite easy for defenders to pass the ball back to me when I played and kick it downfield with your right foot. You know, you weren't kicking off the floor at all. Obviously, it ruined a few keepers when it happened. I mean, I don't think Mark Bresnich should have done well with it. You know, I mean, keepers like that. It's made a hell of a difference, I should presume, to the goal ratio in games over seasons. But I tend to find that most sort of back four players, a lot of players, seem to pass it back to the keeper to kick up field. I think I'd have had some say about it in my day.
Schmeichel or Van der Sar?
Actually, it's a great question. Peter Schmeichel came to Old Trafford raw as a young keeper and established himself as a world-class keeper. I've got to give him so much credit for that. I mean, I would probably go with Peter because he done that. I mean, Van der Sar came and he actually was already a ready-made keeper, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So I'd give it a bit. There was not a lot in it. I mean, two different guys. I mean, they were brave, they were strong, but Edwin was more of a cooler sort of keeper than Peter was. But Peter, you know, sort of had that so much authority to defence.
Another reader, you said about coolness there, another reader said Van der Sar brought so much calmness and authority to the defence, which meant he was needed less. Why isn't a goalie's need to be a good organiser mentioned more?
Well, that's a fantastic question, because, you see, what happens when you have someone like Van der Sar, what happens is he probably knew that's the last goalkeeper that used to catch the ball. Probably Mark Schwartz is still around today playing, and Brad Friedel. I don't think many of them now sort of have carried on the tradition of being a true goalkeeper in catching the ball. Edwin did that. Now, when you're a goalkeeper, if you do that, and that was more or less my aim, basically, if I caught the ball whenever crosses come in and I organise my defence, you're actually back four. When that goes past, that ball goes past them, they know you're there and they feel safe. So they don't back on you. Like you see today, when a lot of goalkeepers are punching the ball, the defences tend to come back because in their own minds, the defenders think, you know, something is not going to happen. Something might happen here and I've got to get back and defend, and it causes havoc in defence.
Who's the best goalkeeper in the world right now?
That's an awkward one because I don't see a lot of, goalkeepers worldwide. I would say, being English goalkeeper, there's only one English goalkeeper, and that's Joe Hart. I mean, I think he's been absolutely fantastic ever since he came on the scene, even when he was at Birmingham on loan from Man City. I thought he should have played in the World Cup in South Africa because he was the best English goalkeeper around in that year. It's a difficult one. I think Pelicek has been fantastic. I mean, even Rayner at Liverpool has been fantastic, but they're going off the ball now. That's because of, I don't know, age or whatever. But I would say in the Premier League today, I don't know about the world because I think that's I don't really know. I mean, you know, you can go on and go on about certain goalkeepers, but I would say Joe Hart's the best in the Premier League.
What about young goalkeepers? Do you think that some of them make the first team debuts too early and never recover from the inevitable stick they get and mistakes they make?
You see, this is all down to young goalkeepers. Not many young goalkeepers get a chance today, and it's the way of the world. It's the way of the media. The media are looking, for others. They can build players up. They can build teams up. They can build managers up, and then then they want to knock them down. But young keepers, there's not a lot of young keepers around, because I don't know why managers, you know, or coaches are not giving them the actual chance. Is it because they're not, you know, they're not good enough? It's a very difficult. I mean, the two lads at Old Trafford now, I mean, they've been there a season now, and looks like they're sharing the spoils at the moment, because you know, mistakes have been made, and I mean, unfortunately for Anders Lingard last year, he got on a good run and he got injured, and David De Gea came back and played very well. Start of this season, things didn't happen for De Gea, and now Anders Lingard has got his chance to show the manager what he's worth and what he did, you know, the experience he gained from last year. And if he can do that, he'll keep the amount that you've paid for any player. The manager is going to play the best player.
How good do you think De Gea, Lingard are or can be?
I think it's going to take time. Whether they can perform. You see, you're never going to get another Schmeichel. You're never going to get another Van der Sar. But, you know, they come along out of the blue for, you know, it might take a decade or two decades. It's one of those things. The manager then, who's had those players, your Schmeichels and your Van der Sar, if you look back through United's history since Rijks has been there, basically, I mean, look what happened with Jim Leighton and the lad from he passed away. What's his name?
Les Sealy.
Yeah, Les Sealy. I mean, Jim Leighton had a nightmare in the cup final, and the manager straight away done the right thing, brought in Les Sealy, and they win the trophy. Then Pedro sort of came on the scene, and that really, he was always number one. You know, and then along come Bosnich and Barclays did for a while, but then, you know, Roy Carroll came in, and there was quite a few sort of ups and downs with Roy coming in and Barclays going out and things like that. So really, until Van der Sar came, there was never an out and out number one. And I don't, obviously, we haven't got that at the moment, Old Trafford. I'd love to see it. I'd love to see one of them come out and be, I am number one. And let's just have to wait and see, unfortunately.
Last few questions now, less than 10 minutes to go. One reader, Phil Holt, who lives near you on the Fylde coast, wants to know if you get mussels out of the river Wyre near your house.
I don't get mussels out of the river. I mean, there are quite a few restaurants along nearly by the Shard and places like that and around Fleetwood, but you know, I don't go scraping mussels off of the river Wyre.
Because he was going to make another point, because if you did, they've just been declared poisonous, so he wanted to warn you.
I won't have any more mussels around here.
A few readers want to know, why did you advocate United sacking Eric Cantona in the wake of the Sellers Park incident, when most United fans would have supported him?
You see, when we were brought up, when I came to Old Trafford, even though I was a Londoner, like I said earlier, the manager became your father in respect. Plus, he was such a gentleman that you looked up to him. He was hard as nails. Don't worry, I mean, Alex Ferguson's hard in the dressing room and everything, but Matt Busby was a very hard man behind closed doors in his office if you stepped out of line. And if you stepped out of line, you know, you had a very strong warning that, you know, if you brought the club into any sort of disrepute, you wouldn't play for him again, basically.
How would he do that? Would he say it to you? Was he physically a big man?
Yeah, I mean, the actual thing, well, I mean, I've done it once, I only stepped out once at Old Trafford, and that was against Estudiantes in the World Cup Championship. I mean, they kicked us off the park over in Buenos Aires, and they were evil. They were spitting at us and going over the top, and I think Dennis had about six stitches down his shin, and it was one of those horrible, that was the hardest sort of ruthless team and place to play in, to be honest.
And what did you do? Did you lose your rag over there?
Oh, when we came back, yes, when we came back, and I just couldn't. I mean, we drew 1-1 at Old Trafford, and of course we lost 2-1 on aggregate. But I just lost my leg, and how they got away with so much. And I think the captain was Bernardo, and I just waited for him as we went down the tunnel, and I just gave it to him, you know. And unfortunately, I got caught on a television camera that was just above the tunnel, and I was reprimanded by the manager in his office the following day, and that was it.
And he said to you, "You just can't behave like this."
Well, that was it. He said, "Look, I'm going to tell you now." He said, "You know, you think you're big." He said, "How do you think we feel? We're downhearted." I mean, he made me look small. I mean, in respect to, you know, he went on about, you know, how do you think the directors feel? How do you think the groundsmen feel? How do you think the laundry ladies feel? How do you think the supporters feel? And you know, there's no answer to that.
And you think he would have felt the same way, having witnessed what Eric did at Sellers Park?
Yeah, I mean, I think he would have done exactly. He would have. He just said, "Look, you do it again, you don't play for United again," and that was it. And of course, you don't do that. And that is not the way. But like with Eric, I suppose at the end of the day, if you think about things, everything's moved on. I mean, how are the managers sort of kept going and going and going? The way things have changed in the game is unbelievable. And you know, he's actually sorted it out as things go on. Things do change in life.
You mentioned the game in Buenos Aires against Estudiantes. Paddy Creran told me that somebody threw a plastic bag at the players, and when he looked inside, it was a bag of meat.
Yeah, well, I mean,
he was going to eat it. He was going to bring it back to Sale.
Well, he would eat it, wouldn't he? No, it was actually, I can vaguely remember it sort of coming out of the dressing room and the tunnel in that stadium, because of the moat around the pitch, and they had all the army, I suppose, you know, with all the tear gas guns and rifles around the pitch. But you came up behind the goal. You didn't sort of come out of the tunnel, you know, but somehow this bag. And I was behind Bobby, and I think he hit Bobby and sort of hit Bobby on his head and as we came out. But and it was like mincemeat.
Finally, how do you think United will do this season? And do you get too many games now? You're living on the Lancashire coast, surrounded by a number of football clubs who are flying, aren't you? Fleetwood, Blackpool and AFC Fylde.
Yeah, it's fantastic area to live in. The surprising thing about it, and is that you're only an hour from United, you know, and I'm fortunate because of, you know, what I've done for the club. I mean, it's a great club. They respect the ex-players so much, you know, for what they've done for them. There's quite a few of us, hell of a lot of us, about 20 of us, I think, that do the hospitality on match days at Old Trafford. And of course, you've also got MUTV as well, so we get invited on that quite a bit. No, it's, I get to every home game and we watch the game and, you know, saying how will they do this year. I mean, look at last year. I mean, people say, well, United never play great, but they finish on the same points and, okay, they were beaten by City on goal difference. It was still, you know, an unbelievable thing when you think that the third place team was Arsenal, 19 points behind them, you know. I think that the season, every season takes off, things happen. I think because the way the manager sort of runs the club and knows how things are going to go, and as players as well, you look for the first 10 games. If you're in there and around at the top of the first 10 games, you know you're in with a chance. And I think that's where we'll be. We'll be up there after 10 games and hopefully we can push on and get the trophy back.
I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Andy.
And thank readers for sending their questions in. And we'll have another United We Stand podcast next week with one of the lads out of the Happy Mondays who's a big United fan. I'm going to meet him in Salford on Sunday morning. Until next week, goodbye.